you tried real hard to go from 0.4 down to 0.35 dB noise figure with your gas-fed preamp, and a guy doing moonbounce looking at cold sky has strong motivation to do that. In some cases, that can make the difference between a QSO and a non-QSO. You therefore have strong motivation to make exactly 50.0 ohms impedance on your Yagi connected to that LNA. I think you see the process. KE2EJ for any more comments or questions. K2LAW.
Speaking of moonbounce.
Yeah, we're going to get to you in a minute, Eric. Go ahead there. I mean, Alex. Go ahead, Eric.
All right, Dick. You know, I see. I mean, I understand perfectly well why you want to create that perfect match. But the one caveat that I wasn't thinking about that you did say is that as long as you don't change the parasitic elements in the process, because there's going to be an interaction. That was the interaction that I was concerned about. But, yeah, I understand. In taking a shunt capacitance across that folded dipole, you will find the point where you can effectively make the inductive reactance zero. I have to play with that one these days. That was very good. I enjoyed that. K2RW, K2J.
I'm very glad you mentioned what you did. In the past, a significant number of people, enthusiastic, well-qualified people, like Frank Toner, F9FT, who ran the Toner Antenna Company for many years in Reims, France. He would use the first director of the Yagi as an impedance matching element of the driven element. When he did that, he was simultaneously changing the antenna pattern while he was doing the impedance matching. One adjustment was contaminating the other. If you've got a real good ratiometry antenna range, where you're capable of really tweaking the living daylights out of a long Yagi and getting maximum gain out of it, you don't want the gain adjusting performance of the parasitic elements to interfere with the impedance matching of the driven element. Yes, they're coupled together. Inefficiency of that impedance match is going to make the apparent gain go down. But when I was doing antenna testing in my own backyard on a range that could resolve better than a tenth of a dB of gain change, a ratiometry antenna range, at times I was getting down to 0.05 dB of resolution. I quite often would find a situation where I adjusted the length of a particular director. The gain would jump up half a dB. At the same time, the impedance match went from 50 ohms to 75 ohms. I didn't go back. I left the director at the position, at the length where it gave me the maximum gain. Then independently, I worked on the driven element. I have to be using a double-step tuner in order to get the impedance back down to 50 ohms. So you want one adjustment to not interfere with the other, to use the first couple of directors, as F9FT used to do, to adjust the impedance match, is a contaminated way of doing it. I will admit that on certain Yagi designs, where the first director is very close, you can do a moderate amount of impedance matching of the driven element without a huge amount of change in the gain and the performance of the Yagi. But it's still a contaminated way to do it, and with this new knowledge, you don't have to do it that way. Now, the guy who asked this original question, we're going to get back to you, Bob. I know we got a little bit left of center of what you were asking, but maybe this is what you were looking for. W2OSR. And then I'll get to all you other guys. Hang in there. K2RIW.
Hi, good folks.
Dick, I'm experimenting with EasyNeck as you're talking there. W2OSR. And I've got my resistive component at 50 ohms, and I'm going to see if I can knock out the inductive component with some C and see what happens.
What you're going to discover, Bob, is not if you can knock out the reactive component. It's what value of capacitor is going to do it. And when you find that right value of capacitor, you will have to go back and readjust the length to make the 50 ohms again. When you're doing it in shunt, I will admit there's interaction between the two measurements. When you put a shunt capacitor across the driven element feed points, believe it or not, you're changing the reactive component that's good, and you're making a minor shift of the resistive component. You're going to have to go back and readjust the length. But after two or three cycles, you're going to get there. It's not if you can do it. You're about to find out how many cycles it takes to make it perfect on EasyNeck. But on your EasyNeck 3.0, I'm a little bit worried, Bob, because occasionally it gives you some answers that I think could be a little better than reality, but we'll find out about that as you make those real measurements in the real world. Now, Alex had a comment, and then Ben had a comment in that order. Alex Ferg, N2NNU, go right ahead, K2LIW.
Yeah, okay, Dick. Not to change the subject, but you said EME. There is a bit of news nowadays that really struck me. It seems that the German radio amateurs were able to do EJE, Earth, Jupiter, Earth, 5 minutes. And what really struck me was that they're showing the screen of the spectrum analyzer. The noise floor was at minus 32.3, and the peak of the signal, very, very nice, defined, clean signal, was at minus 33.5. So just a 0.2 dB signal-to-noise ratio, and they were able to resolve that. That was some picture that I couldn't believe.
Yeah, you called it Earth, Jupiter, Earth. It is Earth, Venus, Earth, EVE. They haven't bounced the signal off Jupiter yet. They bounced the signal off Venus, the Germans, and they used a whole lot of digital signal processing to do this. And I think the total round-trip time was some significant number of minutes. But and they were transmitting a series of pulses, and it's a very nice project done by the guys that are part of AMSTAT-DL, I guess you would call it, the German AMSAT people. And Dr. Karl Meinzer, DJ4ZC, is one of the significant people that was in that group that did that experiment. Very nice experiment. So amateur radio operators have bounced a radio signal with reasonably high signal-to-noise ratio and probability of accurate detection off the planet Venus. And that's a lot weaker than moon bounce. With that capability, they could listen to moon bounce that bounced back and forth between moon, Earth, and moon a couple of times. And there are people who have done that with the Arecibo dish. So when it comes to Reed-Solomon processing techniques, like it takes place with the weak signal Joe Taylor, WSJT, where guys with a single Yagi are now doing moon bounce as opposed to using 16 Yagis on 2 meters or 432. When it comes to these digital signal processing techniques that we used on this particular experiment, with high accuracy, frequency accuracy of the transmitter and receiver, fascinating experiments. And so that's what you were seeing, and you ain't seen nothing yet. There are amateurs now listening to some of NASA's space probes, not worrying about whether or not the antenna pattern of the space probe changes on, say, for instance, the Mars distance coming back to the Earth. Let's see what Bernie had to say about all this. WO2N. Sorry to keep you waiting, Bernie. K2RIW in the TechNet.
No problem. Good evening, Dick. Always a pleasure. And I was just wondering, what you're saying about putting that cap capacitor in there in line, I think in the coax line, does that apply also to, like, vertical antennas, mobile antennas? One question is apply to vertical, because you keep referring to Yagis. And the other question was, if your SWR, let's say, is one-to-one, then I guess you're not worried about inductance or reactance. That automatically should be okay then, I guess, if your antenna's pretty flat. And does it help at all as far as gaining bandwidth of doing that modification? And what was my other question? Oh, yeah, to actually read, to see, and if you, like, most of, when I do an antenna, I just have basically, I'm looking at SWR, and if I can get that down, I'm assuming inductance and reactance are all right. Now, let's say the SWR is high, should you be concerned to find, which you guys are, I guess, to find out if it's inductance or reactance, and to see that, actually, to measure that, I guess you need one of those MFJ antenna analyzers to measure inductance or reactance, or in my case, I just worry about the impedance, and if I can get that matched, I don't really care because I have reactance. I guess it's okay. I'm assuming it's okay, but to see the, any other way to measure inductance without an MFJ analyzer or reactance, like, do you want to go after those two, or just as long as your impedance is good, the antenna's flat? So will it work on mobile verticals? Go ahead, Dick. WO2N. I'm coming in through the East Link.
Very fine, Bernie. Those guys in Master, boy, can they make measurements. You've got a whole set of good questions there, Bernie. I'm glad you asked them. And I've got a lot of good news for you. You don't need to buy the MFJ impedance matching device if you don't want to. And the techniques I'm using, I'm talking about, will they work on a monopole, a 5/8 wave ground plane, a quarter wave ground plane, a driven element of it? Will they work on all of those antennas? Yes, yes, and yes. And the impedance I'm asking you to add, in the case of the capacitor, I'm telling you that it's much simpler mechanically to put the capacitor in shunt, let's say, with the transmission line, not in series. Mechanically, it's difficult to put a capacitor in series with a driven element of a Yagi, for instance. Yeah, a gamma rod sort of does that, but it's not a very symmetric feeding technique. I prefer folded dipole or delta match type of feeding mechanisms. Now, here's the way transmission lines work, Bernie, and this is something that Mel K2KEY has gone through with us when he did his Smith chart study back some time ago. And if you go to the website of amateurradio.tv, www.amateurradio.tv, where you can look at all the past recordings of this technical net for a couple of years. And you can go to a particular section of that particular website and download the audio of Mel K2KEY's lecture on the Smith chart. But I'm going to give you a thumbnail sketch of all this. Let me drop. And that is the way a 50-ohm or a 75-ohm transmission line behaves. Let's talk about a 50-ohm line. If the end of a 50-ohm line sees a load impedance, I don't care if it's your dipole, I don't care if it's a dummy load, I don't care if it's a quarter-wave ground plane, a 5/8 wave ground plane, a mag mount, whatever. If the end of your transmission line looks into what it thinks is 50.0 ohms with no reactance, that is called a one-to-one standing wave ratio. The RF energy goes down that cable, gets absorbed into that 50-ohm load, and none of it comes back to you. If at the end of the line there is any reactance, I don't care if it's capacitive or inductive, I don't care if it's in shunt or in series, if there's any reactance on the end of the line, a reactance by definition does not absorb energy, and some of it will reflect. And when it reflects, you and I on our meter will see it as standing wave ratio. Therefore, by definition, if you've got an accurately calibrated standing wave ratio meter, and if it tells you there is no reflected power, you can either use a bird watt meter where you measure forward and reflected, and you tune until the reflected goes to zero. Or you can really use a double needled standing wave ratio meter. Or you can use a vector network analyzer that measures S11, voltage reflection coefficient. Or you can use the MFJ tool if you like. Whatever tool you use, as long as it's properly calibrated, and as long as you adjust your load so that there is a one-to-one VSWR or no reflected energy, by definition, there is no reactance. You have tuned it out. And you simultaneously made the impedance exactly 50.0 ohms, if that's what your cable is, 50.0 ohm cable. That's the magic of all this. Now, when it comes to tuning a ground plane, 5/8 wave, driven element of a Yagi or whatever, let me drop. If you wanted to know, is it inductive or capacitive, you'd be amazed how simple that is to do. You take a thin little wooden stick. You put a piece of copper tape or aluminum tape on the end of that stick. You stand out of the field of the antenna. You stand back a couple of feet, and you tap that thing. You bring it near the tip of the antenna. Bring it near the tip of your ground plane. Bring it near the tip of your folded dipole-driven element of your Yagi. Bring it near anything you care about. When you bring it near the tip, you're adding capacitance to the tip. You're creating a capacitive top hat. Whether it's just near or whether you make contact, it's up to you. When you do that, you are electrically lengthening the antenna. You are making the antenna more inductive. If that makes the antenna better in standing wave ratio that you measure, then by definition, your antenna was slightly capacitive. If you, when you bring that piece of copper tape near the tip of the antenna and it gets worse, then you know your antenna was already inductive because you just made it more inductive. Believe it or not, putting that capacitor near the tip tunes the antenna to an equivalent longer length where it becomes inductive. I know that's a little bit opposite from common sense, but you'll eventually figure that out. And even if you don't care whether it was inductive or capacitive, you're doing this test, you find out whether it gets better or worse. You bring this tuning tool near the tip of the antenna. If it gets better, you keep doing it. You put a bigger piece of copper tape and you really connect it to the antenna. or then you put a piece of telescoping tubing over the tip of the antenna and you make it physically longer. You'll get there. Once you've chosen the right length by this process, and now you have to find out how much capacitance you put across the tip of the end of the feed line. Call it the terminals of the antenna itself. You're going to create a small, stray capacitance. At first, you're going to do it with a piece of copper tape, and you're going to go across the two terminals where one of the terminals has some paper tape first. That's a gimmick capacitor shunt across the feed point of the antenna. And again, you're going to poke that with a piece of a long wooden stick until you get the exact impedance you want. And you go back and forth between the two. Once these gimmick capacitors give you the performance you like, you say, oh, hold, I have arrived. Now all I've got to do is convert these gimmick capacitors into a real transmitting load, weatherproof, rated capacitor, which is fairly easy. And after that, you've got a perfect antenna if that's what you want.
Repeater, timeout.
I'm amazed that we amateurs have gone this many years downrange without discovering this extremely simple secret. It has been kept a secret from us for no darn good reason. I made this discovery something like 5 years ago, and I've been using it professionally ever since. And I keep saying to myself every day, how come everybody else doesn't know this? How come this has been kept secret from us? How come the antenna books don't tell us this? They give us information that would lead you in this direction if you dig real deep into it. But somehow nobody up till now has put it all together, put it into English in the way that we amateurs can understand it and go out and do it in our backyard. I'm amazed we've gone this many years downrange. We're 80 years into serious electronic tinkering. And this very basic, the most basic antenna on planet Earth, invented by Heinrich Hertz way back in 1867 or whenever, is a dipole. And here we are in the year 2009, learning how to really tune a dipole. You can see I'm amazed by that, that it has been kept a secret from us this long. Maybe I'm overly emotional about this, but how the hell have we not learned this sooner? I wish somebody would explain that to me. Anybody who wants to talk, go right ahead. K2RIW.
Oh, I have a good explanation.
I'm ready for an explanation. Tell me, how did we get here from there, Alex?
They are out.
No, they tried very hard. They meant to. Some.
What a drop.
I guess we are confusing the terminology here, Dick. We are using radio amateur when you really want to say radio operator. And that is the answer to your question. However, I have a related question, and I never thought about it until you didn't speak now. It's about the SWR. This is a ratio between forward and backwards reflected power, so it shouldn't change when you change the input power to the antenna. And yet today I tried three different power meters, and all three showed that the SWR changes with the power applied to the antenna. How is that happening?
Darn good question, and a million amateurs have run into this one. Almost every directional power sensing device you and I can lay our hands on, with the exception of a well-tuned vector network analyzer made by Rode and Schwartz or made by Agilent or Hewlett Packard, with the exception of that instrument, almost everything that you and I can touch is not completely linear. Completely linear means that in the forward mode, when you've got a forward and reverse detecting device and you've got a switch, in the forward mode, if it was an ideal device for measuring VSWR or reflection coefficient, it should measure forward power only and be thoroughly non-responsive to reverse power. That's criteria number one. And the same thing in the other way around when it comes to the reverse power detecting. It should measure reverse power and not be contaminated by any of the forward power. In other words, each of those two detectors should have extremely high directivity of 40 dB if you can get it. That's criteria number one. Criteria number two, the detecting device must be amplitude linear. Well, most of them work on a diode, and most of them have some kind of a quasi-square law diode, and as you feed RF energy into a rectifying diode at very low amplitudes of signal level into the diode with DC bias on the diode will behave in a square law manner for weak signals. for very strong signals, it behaves in a linear manner. As you slowly go from a weak signal to a strong signal into that particular detector, that detector is sliding from the square law manner to the linear manner. The calibration on your meter doesn't quite understand all of that. So therefore, as you change the power reading, power amplitude of your transmitter, your apparent readings on your available Vizwar detecting device will appear to change. And let me give you one other piece of bad news. Stand by a second. Because almost every one of these power detectors you and I can touch do have less than ideal directivity, all you've got to do is put a random length of cable in between the Vizwar detector and your antenna feed line. Just add a little bit of a jumper in there, change the phase length, and all of a sudden, the phase angle of reflection versus forward shifts relative to each other. Therefore, the leakage of the lack of perfect directivity of your detecting devices goes between co-phase and anti-phase or something in between, and again, the apparent Vizwar will change. If you change just, you add, if you've got a 50-ohm transmission line and you add another jumper of a couple of feet of exactly 50-ohm line with good detectors, good connectors on it, and if your apparent Vizwar has changed, you know you've got a slight problem with your detecting equipment. So when you're doing this perfect impedance matching, build yourself an extremely good, or get your hands on a very good dummy load to check the calibration of your Vizwar meter by using your Vizwar meter in the forward mode and the reverse mode. Physically take it out of the system, flip it 180 degrees, connect it back in, and make sure that the reverse and forward power readings change appropriately. And also, if you're smart enough to use a key connector and a pair of 50-ohm loads where you know you're making exactly a 2-to-1 Vizwar, you want your meter to read 2-to-1 Vizwar at various power levels. If it can't meet all those criteria, you know you've got some error. It may be a tolerable amount of error, but I think 95% of all the Vizwar meters we have a degree of error which will not quite allow you to get into the perfection of adjustment that I'm now talking about. So if your instrumentation is less than perfect, then the perfect adjustment you're looking for is not going to be quite what you want. Does that make some sense, Alex? NNU K2LIW.
I4NIL listening. Good evening.
Okay. I heard NIL, and I think you heard him also, Dick. Yeah, I thought so much that the non-linearity of the diodes, detecting diodes and whatnot, are the main reason. So I guess the lesson here it is you get what you pay for. All right, back to you, Dick.
Okay. N4NIL joined us from, I think, Chesterfield, Virginia. Goretta Head Harrison, what would you like to add or subtract from all of this? K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Kilo India 4, November India Lima, Monroe, Connecticut. I didn't realize you guys were so far away.
Okay, I made the mistake of looking up N4NIL, not NI4NIL. Please tell me your name, sir. We're in, on Long Island in New York. Right at the Nassau-Queens border is where this repeater is located. Go right ahead with your question or comment. Please start off with your name, sir.
Well, the name is Frank. The call sign is Kilo India 4 NIL, Monroe, Connecticut. And I was just asking, I just built my first homemade antenna. I'm talking on it now. And about 10 minutes ago, you were saying there was something very important that you couldn't believe hadn't been in the magazines after all this time, blah, blah, blah. I'm wondering what exactly that was.
How to get a perfect impedance match to any dipole or any ground plane antenna with an extremely simple procedure. And that information has been kept a secret from us for 80 years, so to speak, is what I seem to be discovering. So the driven element, the dipole of your Yagi antenna, your 5/8 wave ground plane, your quarter wave ground plane, any of these antennas, by a procedure that indicated at a website where I published an article, you go to the website of WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. I'll repeat that. WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. That's the website, the microwave website of Dr. Tom Williams. You go to the bottom of the first page, and you'll find impedance matching of a Yagi information. And you open up that particular touch point, so to speak, and you'll find an article in which I explained that by changing the length of the driven element of any dipole, no matter where it's located, or any monopole, no matter where it's located, by changing the length, making it longer or shorter than what you think is the proper length, you can make the resistive component go anywhere from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms inclusive. Now, I'm not kidding. However, when you choose the right length where the resistive component becomes exactly 50.0 ohms or 300.0 ohms, whichever you desire, depending on what you're using as a feed line and method, once the resistive component has arrived where you want, most likely the length will be such that there will be a reactive component left over. By a very simple process, you create a gimmick shunt capacitor across the two feed points, and you will change by what is usually an inductive impedance to be a zero reactive impedance. And there's some interaction between the two tunings, but by adjusting the length mechanically or electronically with gimmick capacitors to get the resistive component, by then putting a shunt gimmick capacitor, which you eventually convert into a real capacitor, across the terminals, you can now make the antenna exactly 50.0 ohms resistive if that's what you want. An extremely simple procedure. And here we are, 1870 roughly. So here we are, 130 years.
Repeater, timeout.
Here we are 130 years downrange of the invention of a dipole, finding out how to get a perfect impedance match without making a change in the usual manner. What guys have done up till now is they build gamma rods and adjust the gamma rod, or they build fold the dipole and adjust the ratio of the diameters of the driven element versus the gamma rod in order to try to get the impedance. They start off with a delta match and adjust the mechanical characteristics. They do a bunch of mechanical things on the feeding assembly to try to get the impedance. They get an approximation. They spend a whole lot of hours doing it, and they say that's good enough, and they walk away from it. It doesn't have to be anywhere near that difficult. Just adjust the length and the shunt capacitor and do it in the right sequence with the right understanding using those curves that are included in that article, and you're there. And I'm amazed that that secret has been kept all of these years. Once you study that article, it'll be quite a bit more clear because it's about 1,500 words explaining exactly how to do it, Frank. KI4NIL, go right ahead for any further comment. K2LIW.
It's good to know. I'm afraid that your knowledge far exceeds mine. The antenna that I made is simply a 300-ohm twin lead piece of antenna cable. Found some instructions online on how to turn it into a 2-meter antenna, and it works, but I truthfully have no idea what the feed point impedance is. The radio's heat sink does not get very warm, so I'm not concerned, but that's pretty much the limit of my knowledge.
Once you read, once you try tinkering, once you talk to us further, your knowledge on the subject is going to increase exponentially, Frank, not to worry. And the exact impedance of your 300-ohm folded dipole doesn't matter. By the tuning procedure that's in that article when you read it, you don't care what the exact impedance is. That article is going to show you, just like a blind man walking up a hill, he can feel through his feet which way is uphill, and he'll get to the top of the hill eventually. By the same technique, you will be tinkering with little tuning tools, which are described in the article as to how to build them. With those tuning tools, you'll know which way to go to make the impedance better, on the assumption you've got the right kind of instrumentation that can measure the perfection of the impedance, like a Vizsla standing wave ratio meter, or a reflected power meter, a Berg watt meter, whatever. You can make it perfect if you care. And there are certain situations where we certainly should care, like high-performance antennas with a low-noise amplifier connected. If we don't make a good impedance match to the antenna, then you're throwing away a significant amount of the potential performance of that low-noise amplifier. There was another person who had a comment. Tell me who you are, K2LIW.
I think I can summarize whatever you said out now, Dick, in very little words.
Okay. I'm quite verbose, as you know. Sum it up for us, Alex. Tell me how the Yonkers people would put it into a nice succinct language.
Well, let's see if I can fit it in four or five sentences. First one, you are artificially making the driven element longer, and thus make it inductive. Then you're adding a capacitor on the driven element that will cancel that inductive reactance. The tuning of the antenna is kept in place because of the rest of the the frequency of operation of the antenna is kept in place because of the rest of the elements. Three phases, right?
Give that man a cigar. I think you've got it. So I'm not physically changing the method by which you feed the antenna. I'm not physically changing the position of the antenna. I am just electronically, either by sliding pieces of tubing out of the tips of the dipole, if it's a dipole, or a sliding piece of tubing at the tip of the monopole, if it's a monopole, or putting pieces of copper tape out there as a top hat capacitor, we are changing electrically the length of the antenna, and maybe mechanically. Whatever reactance is left over, we're canceling it in a multi-step process at the feed point, and after that you are there, 50.0 ohms resistive, and your Visual meter will show you as low a number as you've ever seen if you've got a quality Visual meter. You're there. You've got it. Back to you, Alex.
Yeah, I guess the length of the driven element can be arbitrarily made long or short or whatever, as long you have a variable capacitor just for the test at the feeding point. That variable capacitor should be able to cancel out the inductive reactive component of the driven element. Yeah, I see your point. Katie, back to you.
You've got it. You very nicely restated it. And as I said multiple times tonight, I'm amazed that this secret has not been revealed up till now. And those guys at the Kings County Radio Club, I wonder if they have, among their members, found out this little nugget of truth and kept that information close to their chest until today. But that's a little bit of a joke. Over to you, Mel, for any further comments on this. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Please give the website again. Can you give us the website again, please?
Okay, stand by a minute there, Mel. The website is Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. That's the microwave website of Dr. Tom Williams from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. You go to the bottom of his first page, and you'll find an article about Yagi antenna tuning, and you click on that, and you'll eventually get to the article that I'm talking about. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Answer the pause. Let's stand by. Just see if anyone wants to join us via the Internet.
CB2HWW, one quick question, Dick. I can hang a piece of coaxial cable in parallel with the feed line and do it that way, correct?
Without a doubt. That's called a stub tuner, and you choose a stub of the right length, and you can generate any capacitor you want. But in the first step, when you read the article, you'll find out it's much quicker to use a piece of copper tape that you're pushing with a thin wooden stick as you stand off to one side. You get the proper tuning. By various techniques, you find out what that amount of capacitance is, and then with the knowledge that Dr. Seidman has given you and me, you'll eventually figure out exactly what length of stub coax cable will give you that capacitor, and that's a beautiful way of getting a transmitting rated high power capacitor across the shunt of that antenna that can probably take a kilowatt of power. A shunt piece of coax cable stub. An open circuit stub should do the job correctly. So let me turn it over to Mel, K2KEY. Go ahead.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Let's take one more standby, see if anybody would like to join us via the Internet, Dick.
W1ASB Adam, Stanford, Connecticut. Can you repeat that website, please?
Okay, Stanford, Connecticut. The website is Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. The complete website is www.WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. And the bottom of the bottom of that page has the information we're talking about. Back to Stanford.
What about antennas that use the F10 match?
Okay, looks like Stanford is happy. If you're using a hairpin match, the phenomenon is identical. Quite often, if you've adjusted the hairpin correctly, it is a West method of lengthening the antenna electronically. If you've got the exact right hairpin, you can arrive at a perfect impedance match with that. But if your antenna was a little bit low of 50 ohms, for whatever reason, and you go through this tuning procedure on your hairpin match and adjust the electrical length of the antenna by either telescoping tubing at the tip or putting little pieces of copper tape at the tip temporarily, top hat capacitors, by whatever means you can make the resistive component perfect, and then by putting a shunt capacitor, a gimmick shunt capacitor with copper tape if you like, across the feed point of your hairpin, you will again arrive at a perfect impedance match. By watching the response of your VisWarr meter as you do this tinkering with these tuning tools. The tuning tool consists of a piece of copper tape on the end of a long wooden stick, and you hold it in the right spots. Hold it near the tip of the element, you're electrically making the driven element longer. Hold it near the shunt, hold it near the feed point when your coax cable joins the hairpin. You'll be adding shunt capacitance. If you do either of these tuning procedures while you watch the VisWarr meter, you'll know immediately to going in the right direction by the reflected power going down. Again, it's a little bit like a sight-impaired person walking up a hill. The tilt of your feet tell you when you're going in the right direction. In your case, you're going to be watching the VisWarr meter, whether your antenna used to be high in impedance or low in impedance, whether it used to be inductive or capacitive. The exact impedance is academic, not really required. By this tuning procedure, the tuning procedure and the response you get from your VisWarr meter will tell you when you're going in the right direction. When you've gone far enough in the right direction, you're there. You're at the peak of the hill or the bottom of the bathtub of the VisWarr curve. Now, one of the questions that Bernie asked earlier that he didn't answer, let me drop. Bernie asked the question, will this procedure increase the operating bandwidth of your antenna? And the answer in general is no. In other words, yes, if your antenna started off with a 1.7 VisWarr and you only had to tune a little bit higher or lower in frequency to hit 2 to 1, and now you've tuned it to a 1.05, yes, you can tune a little bit further before you hit 2 to 1. But if I really measure the upper frequency of 2 to 1 VisWarr and the lower frequency of 2 to 1 VisWarr, using this procedure, or before using the procedure, have I really substantially increased the bandwidth of the antenna? No. That's not the intent. The intent of this procedure is at your favorite operating frequency to get a perfect impedance match. Now, if you want greater bandwidth of the antenna, that's another whole procedure. And I own a couple of patents on that procedure. And one of these days, I'm going to write another article giving out that little secret. But that's something to look forward to, how to increase the bandwidth of the operating frequency range of your antenna. That's another whole art and science. We'll get into that one later. So with a bit of a drop, I'm going to pass it back to Mel, K2KEY, for comments and or mailbag, whatever you like, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I just gave it a good break there to see if anyone. Do we have to wait 10 seconds to have people join us via the internet stick? Over.
Check in, N2EO. Been listening, but want to check in and say hello.
Yeah, N2MB checking in also. Same deal as Richie. Good evening, everybody.
Hey, we got a couple of personalities here tonight. We got a couple of famous people. We got Barry, N2 Moonbounce. We got Rich, Mr. Tashner, N2EO. Welcome back, Rich. And Rich, we've been discussing real ham radio subjects tonight. I bet you that's part of what brought you out of the woodwork. N2EO for any other comments, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay, Dick. I've been doing some searching, my quest for equipment on various websites and listening with half an ear. So we'll say good evening. I know Mel, I sent both you and Mel a very nice email photograph of the completed Collin Shack. Mel got it. I hope you got it, Dick.
Oh, yeah. Yep, I drooled over it. The photograph that Rich mailed me was a ham radio heaven. If you happen to be a Collins enthusiast, Rich has converted, has created for himself a kind of ham radio heaven, where you walk into that room and you see shelf after shelf of classic Collins equipment in very good restored condition. And so to sit there in front of that equipment and operate the HF frequencies in the classic manner must be quite a bit of pleasure. Barry, sounds like you're mobile, and I wonder how much of the proceedings tonight you were able to gather. We haven't heard from you for a while. N2 Moonbounce, what's going on in your neighborhood, K2IYW in the TechNet?
Okay, I don't want to hold the net up, but yes, I am mobile, and I heard about 75% of the net tonight. I came in a little late because I was just kind of tired and fell asleep, but then I got up because I had to pick up my daughter in Long Beach. You better do that when you got daughters. So I'm just going to stand by and listen to you guys. It's very interesting as usual, and the weather is getting good, so you know what I'm going to be doing. I got lots of antenna projects, so I will be reporting in about their success or failures in the next few weeks. N2MB.
Very good, Barry. Yeah, one night I went over to visit Barry, and where else on planet Earth can you visit a guy in Far Rockaway, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, oh, maybe it was 1:30, he and I climb his Windjammer or whatever the brand name is of self-standing tower in his backyard. I think it's about 80 feet of tower. The two of us at 2 o'clock in the morning climbed the tower, and he showed me what the sights of Manhattan, lower Manhattan, looked like on a nice clear night, a nice calm clear night from the top of his tower. A couple of fairly crazy guys with all kinds of safety harnesses on, so don't worry. And so, yeah, you and I have both got a number of antenna projects that we've got to correct on our structures. So, Mel, once again, back to you, and I don't think it's 10 seconds. I think once we let the machine drop for a couple of seconds, I believe that's enough time for everything to reset such that a person on the Internet is able to check in. But if not, Eric will correct me on that one. K2KEY with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I have some information that you might be interested in, if I may.
Okay, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, just wanted to pass on, had a guy come in, that original table that you see with the main Collins equipment was built by somebody else, but I had a gentleman come in here who put up that second shelf where the AWM-1 is, and he put up a lot of shelves for me. If it's okay, I'd like to give his name and phone number. I don't make any money at this. He's a retired guy, 71 years old. Used to work, and he had a Snap-on tool route, and prior to that he worked as a contractor, and he's reasonable in price. He doesn't do major work, but he did do a lot of shelves for me, the second table. He was very helpful to me. You know, with the bad hip, I can't do these things. May I give his name and number, Dick?
Yeah, briefly do that, Rich. Not too many people are going to go quite as far as you have for building such elaborate shelves to hand to contain all of their individual pieces of classic Collins restored equipment. But for a person who wants that kind of shelving built, briefly, go ahead, give us that name.
Okay. Well, the reason I'm giving it is it's not for very elaborate. He didn't do the elaborate work. He did more or less the mundane work, and he's very reasonable. I had gotten him. There's a recommendation from Whitestone Lumber. You know, I don't know his last name. It's Howard S. Howard S. And his phone number is 718-352-8299. 718-352-8299. He does light carpentry, light sheetrocking, some painting and plastering. You know, this is stuff I would have done myself, but with the hip and the other problems, I can't do it. And he was very, very reasonable in price. So, you know, like I say, I don't make any money at doing this, so I'm sure it's okay to give it out. It was very helpful to me, and if I could pass it on to... And he's obviously familiar with working in a ham shack, because he's been working a mine, and if anybody needs any shelves or any light carpentry in the station, he's a good guy. Yeah, Dick.
Okay, so that information was given to us by Rich N2EO. And Rich, briefly tell us your email address. If people would like to see a copy of the work you're describing and this beautiful Collins equipment in your shack, if someone wants to see that photograph, what email address should they use to talk to you to make that request? N2EO, K2RIW.
Rich is good.
Okay, well, I'll give you my email address. It's N2EO@AWRL.net. If they could just go to QRZ, punch in N2EO, I got a picture on QRZ.
Okay, so you can see a medium resolution picture by going to QRZ.com, N2EO. Or if you write directly to Rich, you'll get a high resolution photograph mailed to you of what the carpenter did, what his Collins, what I call a ham radio heaven, looks like. If you're a Collins enthusiast, you might want a copy of that. Mel next, K2KEY, with enough drop to let the machine drop a couple of seconds. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N, a question for Mel, HF vertical.
Yeah, go ahead there. Here we go. My mind's going blank, Paul. WS2N, you got it.
Okay, I know Mel is really into HF, so I was thinking about a vertical. Took these trees down, getting really tired of the dipoles. I have a 20 and 80-meter dipole up there for years. But I was thinking about the Titan DX that's advertised in QST. I wonder if Mel maybe knows, you know, is familiar with it. I mean, they claim 10-meter, 12-meter, 15-meter, 17, 20, 30, 40, and even 80 meters with this 25-foot tall antenna. Sounds like it's mounted from the ground. I don't know if you're familiar with it or if I should even consider this. You know, I've got a phone number here and a website. They say no radials required. That tells me that you don't have to put any copper wires into the ground. That's what it sounds like. So just curious. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, one of those things that we've discussed a number of times, Paul, is that if the radiating system of your vertical antenna is electronically half-wave long or something like that, 5/8 wave, half-wave, in that vicinity, as opposed to quarter wave, you're really feeding a half-wave dipole from the bottom end. As such, you're feeding something like 1,000 ohm impedance with the impedance matching device that's probably built into the base of the antenna. And once you do that, whether it be a commercial product or a homebrew product, that type of antenna, in my opinion, has been very poorly represented up till now. And if you're smart enough to raise it above ground level, you even get some further performance improvement from two reasons. One, you're feeding less power into the earth. And number two, you have a higher phase center, which gives you a lower angle of radiation on the horizon. And you clear your local terrain and the obstacles on that terrain better. Vertically polarized, half-wave electronic structures have got a lot going for them. And that elevated feed that Mel and I have been discussing falls into that category. Now, Mel, Paul just mentioned a particular commercial product that you might be familiar with. And you guys with your shootouts that you've held at the Kings County Radio Club, maybe you've got some opinions about it. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet. We're going to wait until it drops for a few seconds.
Okay. This is K2KEY. Well, we've been discussing it the last few weeks, Paul. It came up here a number of times on the net here about whether or not the gap antenna, the one that you are mentioning, the Titan DX, the multiband antenna, and a number of people have emailed me, and I had made a statement, and I got punished for it a number of times by a certain person that is involved with the company, and the point making that I said that if you took a dipole at the time, I said you took a dipole and just basically vertical dipoles that you're most likely going to do just basically the same thing with some hunks of wire that cost literally absolutely nothing almost, and compared to a antenna that is kind of pricey. So again, we go back to the same situation. Could this antenna outperform a dipole at the same height in a number of dipole configurations, such as slopers or vertically hung dipoles or whatever, and because of its elevated feed, Dick? What is the final word on that, Dick? Over.
The GAP antenna is a perfect, excellent dummy load, and to an annual.
Okay, there are people who love it, and apparently Alex is not so pleased with it. The theory of operation, I am led to believe, is significantly better than an ordinary quarter-wave ground plane with 32 radials, or a small number of radials. Now, Mel asked for the final word. I don't think there's a final word. I know for a fact that neither he and I have done yet an exhaustive study as to how that antenna works. It sounds like Alex has owned one, has used one. Some of the guys at the Kings County Radio Club have used it and are relatively pleased. Sounds like Alex is not pleased. So, Alex, give us a few words as to where you bought it, when you bought it, where you installed it, how you installed it, and what made you feel that it was a dummy load and not a good radiating antenna. N2NNU with some hands-on experience. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, I bought their very first product. What was that, a Challenger or something like that? I forgot. It goes back 10 years or whatever. I still have the aluminum hanging around here for some other reasons. Well, I bought it because they were advertising it as a non-radial vertical, and I, as a sucker, I forgot about my basic training. So I bought it, $350 at the time. Oh, God. Well, let's forget about the SWR and whatnot, but on receive, it is a dummy load. I mean, a simple dipole, a horizontal dipole, was receiving an S9. This Challenger was receiving an S1. And why? Because inside the tubing, there are 27 feet of lossy cable. That's where my signal went. That's my experience. I wanted my money back. They did refuse, so I said, okay, we'll see what we're doing about it.
Is it possible, Alex, that you were buying a earlier product and that the later product has made improvements over the product that you bought? Is there that possibility? I know you probably have no good way of answering that, because after spending the first $350 and feeling dissatisfied, you are not willing to invest money again for the later product. But so I'll give you an opportunity. There are people who have bought the later product who seem to be pleased with it. So is there any possibility that there was an error in your installation, or there's something peculiar about your particular installation? And again, is there the possibility that the earlier product was not as good as the later product? N2NNU for any further comments. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I think I spent about 5 hours on the telephone with them trying to make it run. So when I say run, it is, I don't mind the transmission. Okay, transmission, no matter how poor it is, I can live with it. SWR was through the sky, so they told me then I need some counterpose. I said, wait a second, you sold me here an antenna that doesn't need ground planes. Well, a counterpose is not a ground plane. I remember that as today, you know. Okay, so on receive, it was a really dummy load. I mean, once I took out the 27 feet of cable from inside, the receiver did improve a lot. However, you really need radials. I wanted to mount it on my chimney, because that's what they sold me. But it didn't work on the chimney. I had to be underground with a bunch of radials. That's my experience with them. I don't think I'm going to buy from them anymore. Why?
Okay, there's a personal hands-on experience. And I'm with you. The word counterpoise and ground plane have an extremely strong similarity to each other. In the case of a real dipole, really a half-wave dipole, you could say, is a quarter-wave ground plane to the right of center and a quarter-wave ground plane to the left of center. And once you've got a thoroughly symmetric dipole, whether you put the right-angle sheet of metal in the middle to make it look like a complete ground plane to the right or left, doesn't matter anymore. That's the line of symmetry. And when the antenna is operating, your transmitting line, your transmission line is acting like a pump. It is grabbing some electrons from the left half and shoving them to the right half on the first half of the cycle, and then shoving them back from the right half to the left half on the second half of the cycle. So in the case of a full half-wave dipole, if you want to call the right-hand side the radiator and the left-hand side the counterpoise, you could do that if you wanted to. In the case of a pure quarter-wave antenna, you need the real ground plane radials to act like the source of those electrons that you're going to pump in and out of the real radiator. That's the counterpoise, the source of the electrons you pump. It's the mirror image of the other half of the missing dipole. Once you make the radiating element electronically a half wave, and if you're smart enough to do it with lossless materials, you gain a huge performance improvement. The quarter wave ground plane is something like 30 ohms of base impedance. A half wave radiator in a ground plane-like structure, you're feeding something like 1,000 or 2,000 ohms at one end. And therefore, the need for the ground plane radials drastically decreases. Doesn't quite go to zero, but drastically decreases. And if it really was a half wave, let me drop. If it was an electronic half wave radiator fed from one end, with constructed out of lossless materials, you should have had high performance with essentially no ground plane radials. So the loss of the components involved seems to have been a contributing factor to the lack of performance you had of that particular earlier product. Now, maybe Mel and the guys who, one of the guys that Mel works with bought the antenna, built it. I think Mel helped him assemble it. I think the guy put it into operation, and I believe that particular person in Brooklyn was relatively pleased. Mel's going to give us more specific information. And I presume it was a later product that Paul was talking about here. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, let me make a rough precision. Last comment about this. The antenna itself is an asymmetrical vertical dipole, and that's what it's supposed to be. But why they put so much wire inside, and the capacitor to tune out the inductor reactive inductance there? Why they claim they need counterpoise on asymmetrical dipole, that's beyond me. Okay, sorry for that. And to an enemy.
No, I hear what you're saying, Alex. You believe the advertisement was saying one thing and the product delivered to you wasn't quite as advertised, that with the weasel wording of ground plane versus counterpoise, that other things had to be added that you didn't wish to add for whatever reason, your mechanical layout, your particular chimney, and so on. So I think you're saying that of that particular earlier product, your performance was different than the advertised performance. Let's see what Mel's got to say about the one that you assembled. And by the way, one interesting experiment that I now know would have been fun to do, Alex, would have been you feel that all of the extra cable that was wound inside the antenna, the extra coaxial-like cable, was a loss mechanism. It would have been darn interesting to pump 100 watts into the antenna, key down for 10 minutes, turn it off, go over there and see if anything is wrong. That would have been a very interesting science experiment that we now know about. But you no longer have the antenna, so you can't do that. Let's see what Mel's got to say, and how pleased is the guy in your neighborhood who built the later product, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Forgive me, please. You touched the red button here. I did that experiment with about 500 watts. The whole cable and the capacitor inside exploded in my face. And they are qualifying this antenna as a 1 kilowatt antenna, or at least they did that at the time. All right, I'm keeping my mouth shut now.
Wow. Yeah, you probably did it 500 watts key down. and maybe they didn't carefully word it enough, and maybe they only meant 500 watts peak envelope power or kilowatt peak envelope power in sideband service, whereas a guy running radio teletype or T-down testing, that's a very different service. The fact that it got that hot and exploded does suggest that the parts were